Assistant Attorney General Stephen Kleinmeier to present the case for the state of Wisconsin.
Yes, may it please the court. My name is Stephen Kleinmeier, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the state of Wisconsin and plaintiff, respondent, petitioner. This case is here on review of a decision of the Court of Appeals that reversed the judgment of conviction that had been entered in the Circuit Court for Rock County. Very briefly, the case arises out of the police execution of a search warrant at the defendant's home, where the police found cocaine and marijuana and other evidence, and they made a no-knock entry to execute the warrant. The entry, the no-knock was authorized by the search warrant. Now, the case presents five issues. The first two concern the validity of the search warrant. Those are whether the affidavit for the warrant stated sufficient facts, sufficient information to support a finding of probable cause to believe that evidence of the crime would be found in the defendant's home. The issue related to that is if the court finds the search warrant was not sufficiently supported, so it was invalid, then the question is whether the evidence is still admissible under the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule. Now, these two issues concern both issues the defendant raised in the circuit court when he challenged it under the Wisconsin as well as the United States Constitution, the Fourth Amendment. The other three issues concern the no-knock entry by the police. And the first one, in this case, the state and the trial court here conceded that the entry made in December 1996, which was before the decision, the United States Supreme Court decision in Richards versus Wisconsin, did not satisfy the criteria in Richards versus Wisconsin. So under Richards versus Wisconsin, it violated the Fourth Amendment. The question then is whether the evidence is still admissible, and the state contends it is. First reason being that, and the first issue is the argument that even when there is a violation of the Fourth Amendment, by failing the police comply with the rule of announcement, the evidence should not be suppressed since there's no causal relationship between the illegal police conduct and the seizure of the evidence. Second issue related to this, there are two more issues now on the no-knock, and they are both related to good faith issues. If the court finds that the exclusionary rule otherwise applies, the issues are whether police could rely on this court's blanket rule, State versus Stevens and State versus Richards, in good faith in making this no-knock entry, and whether that reliance satisfies for an application of the good faith exception. And the other good faith is based on the search warrant, which also authorized the no-knock entry. Now, State contends that these last three issues, all relating to no-knock, arise in this case only under a challenge to the Fourth Amendment, because in the suppression motions, the defendant relied only on the Fourth Amendment and the Richards versus Wisconsin to allege that the no-knock was illegal. The facts, briefly, were they're pretty much uncontested, I believe. The police executed a warrant at the home of another individual, Darrell Vance, found drugs there. And then Mr. Vance, on December 2nd, identified to a police officer his supplier as Lance, who lives on Royce. This is in Beloit. The police checked the tax rolls, found that Lance R. Ward lived at 1663 Royce, and they had other information in their files connecting him, identifying him as a drug dealer. The officers I cited in the affidavit his training experience that persons involved in drug-related crimes are often armed and destroy evidence, and asked for a no-knock warrant. The judge issued it. Now, this was in December 1996. This was before Richards versus Wisconsin. The judge issued the warrant. The police on December 4th, 1996, at about 8:50 p.m., went to the home. About six officers, one officer yelled, "Police search warrant," and the police immediately entered. They didn't allow any time. During the search, they found 180 grams of cocaine, 2,500 grams of marijuana, and some other evidence. When the suppression motions were brought, they were first heard in February of 1997, and the judge found that the no-knock entry was valid, relying on the blanket rule. This is, again, still before Richards versus Wisconsin. He found that the search warrant was valid because he said in his experience, and he could rely on his experience to infer that the drugs would be found at the home of the drug dealer. His experience in 8 years in Beloit was that drug dealers dealt the stuff out of their homes and that the evidence would be found there. The defendants subsequently entered a plea to two charges pursuant to a plea bargain, and the sentencing was set for a later date. By the time sentencing came along, Richards versus Wisconsin had been decided, The defendant filed a motion for reconsideration against citing the Fourth Amendment, Richards versus Wisconsin, challenge to no-knock. And at that hearing, defendant conceded that the police acted with their actions justified under the law applicable at the time of the entry, and there was nothing in the record indicating that the officers acted improperly under that the blanket rule of law at that time. The trial court again denied the suppression motion, relying this time on a good faith exception, saying the police simply complied with the blanket rule that was in existence at that time, and again denied the challenge to the search warrant, again relying on the experience. On appeal to the Court of Appeals reached only the first issue, the search warrant issue, because the court found it was not supported by probable cause. Therefore, the search was invalid. On the question of good faith on the search warrant, it said it did not have the authority to adopt a good faith exception to the exclusionary rule. That would be something for this court to do. Now, on the merits of the challenge to the affidavit, the Court of Appeals points out, in the trial court, the defendant conceded that the affidavit provided probable cause to believe he was a drug dealer. His challenge was that it didn't provide probable cause to believe that evidence would be found in his home when the search was going to be executed. The state submits that the evidence is, that there is enough, there are enough facts in there from which the court could infer that the drugs would be found there. I think it's important to keep in mind the standards of review when there's a search warrant issued. They're stated extensively in Higginbotham, which is just a summary of stated many times, but the judge or magistrate who issues the warrant is accorded great deference when it's reviewed. The judge must be apprised of sufficient facts which say an honest belief in a reasonable mind the objects will be found where the search is going to be executed. And in line with that, in State versus Tompkins, which was talking about probable cause and where you find something, says it's not so constrained to mean a particular location and not any other location. You have probable cause, and a reasonable person could conclude that evidence sought is likely to be in a particular location. There may be information that's elsewhere, but as long as it's likely in at least this spot, there's probable cause for that spot.
Well, as your physician counsel, and I was somewhat confused about your briefs on this, but you can explain. Is the state's position that every time you have a drug dealer, that is a charge of a drug dealer in the affidavit, that the inference can be made that that there will be drugs in the home, in the residence, and therefore the search warrant can apply to the home?
If that experience is justified by experience, yes.
Well, whose experience?
Well, I think it could be that the judge as well as the defendant said it could be the judge or the police officer. If it's a police officer, he puts it in there, and it's for the judge to review. If it's the judge, it's going to have to be, the state's position is that's a legitimate consideration for the judge to use when drawing the inference based on the information that's in there.
Well, suppose we have a brand new judge on the bench in Rock County and comes from a civil practice, and you got this kind of warrant. Is that the state's position then? And the police searched the home. Is the state's position then that search had no probable cause?
No, I think it would have to be that in the Fourth Amendment cases, there's an objective standard applied.
Well, then that goes back to my question. And is it your position that as an objective standard in all cases in which the affidavit says it's a drug dealer, you can search the home? I mean, it doesn't matter what the cop says in the affidavit or what the judge's past experience is, because it's objective.
Well, yes, and that is a position that's been taken in several cases.
That is that as a matter of law, there's probable cause to search the home. Is that your position?
Yes.
Mr. Kleinmeier, let me ask you a question, and I should know this, but I'm not clear. Was the magistrate who issued the search warrant a Judge Welker?
Yes, he was the same person who heard conducted the suppression hearing.
If you had a different issuing magistrate than the judge now conducting the hearing, how can the judge know what the magistrate relied on? I understand Judge Welker could know what he relied on, But how do you bridge that gap in the opposite situation?
Well, for an objective standard, you wouldn't be looking at what that particular magistrate thought and say this is something that a reasonable person could infer based on this information. If the court decides that she can't rely on an objective standard, then I guess the only thing it would be is the magistrate would have to be subject to being called as a witness at a later hearing, whether it's the same one who's there, obviously there in Cattell. If it's a different one of the parties, presumably the state would be in a position they'd have to call.
So the objective standard approach would actually support the position you're taking?
Yes.
Boy, I hear it differently. Let's say I grew up in... the ages of the kids, you have to be careful. But let's say I grew up and my experience with drug dealing was never brought it out of the house, always got it on a corner. I mean, I can tell you what corner, you know, we always got it on. I'm saying this hypothetically, I don't mean this at all. So, now I'm a judge, and someone comes to me and has the same affidavit here, and I say, boy, there's no probable cause to search that house because it's always obtained on the corner of Fifth and Vine. It seems to me that the subjective test, which you are implicitly espousing, is unworkable for a reviewing court, because it's based on the subjective life experience.
Well, I think I'm saying a subjective test, but and even in your example, just because the person sells in the corner doesn't mean, you know, when he's not at that corner, he's got to have his store his drugs, and there's other evidence besides just the drugs. And as the judge pointed out here, he's not going to have a store that he sells it out of where he can, you know, stock his wares there. And the most likely case, as other courts have pointed out, is that it's going to be at the home. And this is the Burnt case, which we have cited, said, when then does logic and common sense dictate that it would be kept? There's only one answer, his residence. A magistrate's not required to ignore the lessons of experience or to disregard logic and common sense.
My concern is, and you are in this, the standard of review. What I must do as an appellate court and what others must do in reviewing subjective inferences. As I understand it, the standard of review for probable cause determination is whether the magistrate had substantial basis for the determination. Where's the substantial factual link in this case?
Well, I think there is a link in the affidavit when the Ms. Darrell Vance, the first person who was arrested, identifies Lance Ward, identifies the supplier as Lance, who lives on Royce. His only identification of his supplier is a first name, and it's the street. I think there's an inference there that his connection is with the supplier on Royce. And if the person lives on, then I think it's reasonable to infer that that connection on Royce is the residence. So I think his identification in this affidavit of Lance on Royce provides that additional link, connects his supplier to the Royce address. That, coupled with the general experience, would be sufficient here.
But if there had been no address, but you could easily find it in the phone book.
Pardon?
If there had been no address in the affidavit, and you could find this address in the phone book or the police know his home address, and that probable cause to search a home of a drug dealer is, as a matter of law, reasonable, objectively, that's your position, as you stated it, then the fact that there was an address in the affidavit is irrelevant, isn't it?
No, I think that would get the particularity requirement of the warrants, that they have to particularly describe the place to be searched and the items to be seized.
But it's not a probable cause issue, then. It's a particularity issue.
Yes.
Okay.
Could I ask whether Mr. Ward had any drug convictions prior to the search?
That was not presented in the affidavit, and I don't. That may have come up at sentencing. I don't recall if there were. But as far as I don't think that was included in the affidavit. And
was there some urgency in executing the warrant so that the police officers couldn't go and try to get some additional information about drugs at that premises?
That I don't know. But I don't, I mean, whether they could have taken further other steps, I don't think really goes to whether this affidavit was sufficient, though. I mean, they may have been able to. I don't recall if that was discussed, if, you know, whether they could have waited or not, what other steps they could have taken, whether that was discussed at the hearing. But I don't think that that would go to the issue of whether this affidavit was sufficient.
You drew a connection between Mr. Vance, I think, saying that the residence was on Royce. What, if that connection was valid, why couldn't they simply go back and say, were you ever in the Royce premises or residence, and did you see drugs there?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, could have been a question that was asked. I'm sure they could have followed. There could have been other steps taken, I'm sure. Asked that question, you know, keep the house under surveillance for a period of time. Other things could have been done. Maybe there was some urgency. That's not in the record. So what we have is this affidavit. I think this approach is consistent with decisions that this court already has made. In Tompkins and Higginbotham, because in Tompkins, again, there was a possibility of the drugs there being in three or four different locations, and the court said the question is whether it's likely to be in a particular location is all that has to be found. It doesn't have to exclude all others. I think that links in with the Pitts case we've cited and the Berth case, where they just say, you know, look at common sense and we'll see where these drugs are likely to be, whether it's reasonable to conclude. And also with Higginbotham, where the issue there was whether the police had, whether the warrant was sufficient to search the home of the defendants, the suspects, and the court there went at great length discussing why there was probable cause for these two suspects, or the three suspects, I think, and their address, said you have to have a nexus between the defendants, the suspects, and the location, and said because of their nexus to the home, they're living there, the Fraser property was a likely storage or hiding place for the sought-after shoes, gloves, and flammable liquids that could link the suspects to the crime. These are items commonly kept at the home. That was the answer to the court. Went from the identification of the suspects, where they lived, the nature of the items being sought, and then just simply found, drew the conclusion, since they're likely to be kept at the home, there's probable cause. I think that's the same situation here. The next question then is if the court finds that that's not sufficient and there wasn't probable cause to suspicion nexus to the home, then the question is whether the evidence should be suppressed. And the state is arguing that no, one of the good, we should adopt the good faith exception of the Wisconsin Constitution and not suppress it. Now, under the Fourth Amendment, to the extent there's a Fourth Amendment challenge, I think Leon requires that you apply the good faith exception. I think to follow the U.S. Supreme Court on Fourth Amendment issues. Leon would apply it for a search warrant when the police rely on a search warrant, and therefore this court would have to apply it. Leon lists some circumstances when the good faith exception would not apply. I don't think those exceptions apply here. Those are whether when the judge abandons his detached and neutral role, if a detective was dishonest or reckless in preparing the affidavit, and there's no allegation of that. If the police could have harbored an objectively reasonable belief in the existence of probable cause, I think that's the objectively reasonable officer could. I think the cases we've cited from other jurisdictions, at least whether the court agrees or not, at least provide some support for the police to draw that conclusion when there's no guidance from Wisconsin cases on this. Whether the search warrant was facially defective, I don't think there's a problem there. On the question of abandoning, the magistrate abandoning his detached and neutral role, defendants argued he did that here, but in Ventresca, they discussed that and cited Aguilar versus Texas, and that Aguilar was a case where they said he abandoned his neutral role, but that was where the police officer came in and said, relying on my informant, I believe there's drugs at this location. That was the extent of the affidavit. There was no facts or anything, just the officer's conclusion. I said, when you rely on the officer's conclusion with no facts, then that's the
Mr. Kleinman,
the role. But that's not the case.
What are the building blocks in this affidavit that add up to probable cause? Building blocks and facts.
Um, Well, Daryl Vance had 3,300 grams of marijuana, and he identified his supplier, so presumably his supplier is even higher up the chain than him. He identified his supplier as Lance, who lives on Royce, which again I think connects his supplier to the address on Royce. And then the specific address was found because the police found a Lance R. Ward, living at 1663 Royce. So that ties to the specific address on Royce. That plus the experience, the inference the court can draw.
You answered just to the chief as saying it really doesn't matter whether the magistrate is experienced or not. The first day on the job magistrate could make draw this inference, right?
Well, the first day on the job magistrate, the police are obviously taking their chances whether that magistrate's going to be familiar enough to draw the inference. When I said the inference, that was a question of review on what kind of standard would be applied, and I think it's an objective standard. But as a practical matter, I think that the police are really running a risk. The magistrate may well not issue it. I mean, they may say, I don't know about this. I can't make any connection.
But if the police...
They may not say it and just refuse to issue it.
But why wouldn't the magistrate be able to draw the inference that these police officers are experienced and they know where these drugs are kept, and if they apparently believe they were kept in the home?
Well, if the police are going to rely on the experience of the judge to fill in the inferences, they're taking their chances. Cases have said the judge can, or the issuing magistrate can rely on his or her experience to draw inferences. If the police are going to hope that the judge has the experience to draw the inference, they're taking a risk. Here they had an experienced judge.
But are you saying that if the police were to throw in a sentence in the affidavit that they are experienced and it's their common experience that these drugs are kept in the home of drug dealers, that's enough?
That's enough, and the defendant conceded that at trial. He said if the police had put that in his affidavit, he wouldn't even be challenging it. And Ventresca, this court says that police officers can draw inferences based on their experience. Ventresca says it's the magistrate who's supposed to be drawing the inferences, and we want the magistrate drawing the inferences, not the police. Which seems the police are entitled to draw that inference as they were allowed, permitted to do in Tompkins. Then the magistrate certainly be ought to. It would be ironic if the police were permitted to draw inferences that the magistrate issuing the warrant can't draw.
It sounds to me just like Stevens and Richards.
Well, I think a vast difference there is the blanket rule. One of the reasons the U.S. Supreme Court didn't like that, it was a court-made rule. If experience changes so that the experience that was the underlying basis for that rule changes, the rule is still there. Whereas if you're relying on experience, that's going to, I mean, the experience is going to change as customs and activities change. I think it's one thing to say, if you're going to say that you can never rely on experience, I think there's a whole, multiple areas of law that have to be reviewed. To say you can't rely on experience overrules Terry v. Ohio. Because there they said the police officer had reasonable suspicion to believe the person had a gun because he was a daylight robber. And you can assume daylight robbers have guns unless they, otherwise. This court has said reasonable suspicion to frisk a drug dealer because drug dealers are armed. I mean, there's a whole array of things where courts have said police or magistrates or judges can rely on experience to draw inferences. If you're going to say now that every time relying on experience, that's an invalid blanket rule. But I think that's a vast extension beyond Richards versus Wisconsin. It's not contemplated by
anything. You conceded, I think, by conceding that this evidence was not admissible under Richards, that the experience, which they outline here, they outline a lot of their experience with drug dealers, and they say that based on their experience and associations, persons involved in illegal activities often arm themselves with weapons. And you're saying that's not enough.
Well, in this case,
you conceded it's not.
Had the record been here, we may be challenging this court's decision in State v. Meyer also. But in this case, the police officer, there was evidence brought out at the suppression hearing that they questioned whether that statement of experience on weapons was accurate. And I think there was, I don't recall the exact details, it's in the defendant's brief primarily, where this officer had like 20 prior search warrants and found a weapon in maybe one of them. Statistics, something like that. Which, with his actual experience, would have been hard. We've been hard pressed to challenge that. But I, I just think to say that everything now where someone relies on experience is an invalid blanket rule. It's just an extension of Richards versus Wisconsin. It's not contemplated by case, because that case, remember, involved a decision by this court. A court decision that is going to stand forever until changed, no matter what happens with experience or customs. That's still standing.
Your universe seems much larger. You say to say that every time that you rely on experience, that it's an invalid blanket rule. I want to shift the universe and deal with this case. Help me, because it sounds to me what you're saying, the flip side of that, is what you seem to be arguing, is that there is a blanket rule for probable cause to search a drug person's home. That's what you seem to be saying.
Based on experience.
You're not saying that, tell me.
Well, it's based on the experience and as the court said in Burns, the logic of collusion. I mean, when you come to a no-knock case, one big difference between that and these cases is no-knocks, there's many times that no one in the house has a gun, they don't resist, and they don't destroy drugs. When this kind of situation, you have a drug dealer, he's got to have his drugs somewhere. There's got to be evidence somewhere. The question is where. And as the court said in Burns, in his case, you can look to the nature of the evidence, the type of crime, and it's logical, you know, it's a logical conclusion. It's just likely that he's going to have it at his home. Where else is he going to have it? He doesn't have a store to keep it in. He doesn't have a warehouse normally. A car is going to be a house. It could be a car, but as in Tompkins, you don't have to eliminate all the possibilities. Under Tompkins, it's just as likely to be in the house as in the car, and I think under that rationale that we've employed in Tompkins, you still have probable cause to search the house.
Thank you, Mr. Kleinmeier. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal, and the next case, too. Mr. Dunn.
Good morning, members of the court. Mr. Kleinmeier. My name is Daniel Dunn. I represent the defendant in this case. I have ceded 15 minutes to Dean Eisenberg. It was my hope that I could talk about the facts of the case, answer any questions about that, talk about the warrant, as I had the luxury of being the trial court attorney, and hopefully kind of curve the Leon questions to Dean Eisenberg, but that's how I tend to proceed.
I authorized that. You requested that sometime, and I'm sorry I don't have the date, but I did authorize that.
Thank you very much. My understanding of what the state is asking here, and I'm talking about their first issue, and that is referencing the affidavit in support of the warrant, I read it as they're asking for a blanket rule, and they want you to promulgate that rule. A legal presumption, if you will, a blanket rule, saying that anytime you have identified a person as a drug dealer, for purposes of probable cause, any magistrate or any judge can then make a determination that you are likely to find drugs in that person's residence. That's how I read their brief, and I don't think that they denied that's the case. And I would suggest to you that what it amounts to is almost like a general warrant of assistance. It doesn't contemplate judicial review. See, the beauty of the state's argument is that once they get the Supreme Court to say this is okay, what's left to review in terms of...
Mr. Dunn, let me interrupt.
Certainly.
Why doesn't it make sense that at least in the vast majority of cases when you've got a drug dealer, there's going to be drugs in his home? That seems to me to follow almost as surely as night following day.
And therefore,
there's probable cause to believe there's sufficient. It's sufficient that a drug dealer equals probable cause to search his house.
In all cases, no.
What doesn't make sense about that?
Well, first of all, in the context of this case, it wasn't. This is something that the judge made a decision to decide. I don't think that Judge Welker here made an inference. I think what he did is he looked outside the experience of the affidavit, ignored the four-corner rule, and he supplied the fact that was necessary upon which to make the inference that there might be drugs in Mr. Ward's home. And that's, under any historical analysis, that's not the correct way to do things. For one thing, you have a separation of power problem. I think that once the judge takes off the judicial hat and puts on the coat of the police officer, and then puts a fact in the affidavit, and then makes an inference from that, he's violated the neutrality. He's become not a member of the judiciary. He's become a member of the police department, and that's the executive branch. This is what the state tried to do in this particular case. And there's
even a Higginbottom say you can do that in some situations? If it's a shoe and a glove, that it's a reasonable inference, and you're looking for someone's shoe and glove, that it might be in their home?
I think that Higginbottom was discussed in the Court of Appeals decision, and that was rejected. I don't exactly remember why, but let me indicate. I think there's a reason. There's a way to decide this case.
I'd like an answer to my question. Let's take it out of Judge Walker's court. Just we're all here talking today. Doesn't it make sense that when you've got a drug dealer, you're going to find drugs in this house?
In my experience, and I've seen hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of police reports, affidavits, you find drugs anywhere. Now, you find them in cars, they deal out of businesses, they deal out of state government. In the Jefferson County case a few years ago, the district attorney was dealing out of the judge's chambers. So if you're going to say, and that's true, if you're going to say that you find them in the houses, then basically what you're allowing is that any time a judge or a magistrate wants to issue a warrant, they could say, well, he's a drug dealer, therefore it could be anywhere he goes. Could it be in the house? Could be in the house. But for particularizing a reason why you want to get into a person's house, don't you want a little more? As a reviewing judge, as a supervisory judge, do you want to let...
For your house, yes. But there's no question here that it's been established that he's a drug dealer. At least we're assuming that he's a drug dealer.
Well, he was convicted in reverse, so I mean, you can make that assumption.
Well, for purposes of the affidavit.
Right, I mean, that's right. I wouldn't have challenged on that ground. And I'm sorry, your question again? You want me to...
I agree that we can't just let somebody in because they say Mr. Dunn is a bad guy. But if they say Mr. Dunn is a drug dealer, now the question becomes, can we get into your house?
No, I don't think so. And why would you particularize drug dealers? Are you going to do that in the cases of murderers? Are you going to say that everybody who commits a murder must have a gun in his house? Are you going to say that everyone that is seen on the internet trafficking in child pornography probably has child pornography in his house, even if he used the computer, he or she used the computer from the place of work? I mean, I think you're opening Pandora's box here, and I don't think you want to do that. With respect to this
could I then ask you, given the strong possibility that there be drugs in a drug dealer's home, what additional facts would you like to have seen in the affidavit?
Well, Your Honor, I think Judge Walker could have turned to this police officer and said, Officer Anderson, I note that you have in the affidavit reference to four pieces of intelligence from special operations. What have you got in there to suggest that there might be drugs in this house? In my particular case, that should have been done. Or Judge Walker could have said, I notice there's nothing in your affidavit that suggests that there ever were drugs in the house, there was no dealing or anything of that nature. Give me a little bit more. Section 968.12 says that all you got to do is raise your hand. Gee, if it's real important stuff and you don't want anybody to know about it because it's in the special operations file, you can tell me. I can seal that warrant. I mean, what else have you got? In this particular case, and I think this goes not only to the warrant, but also to the general good faith of the police police here, they had a file for them that said, this man's a drug dealer. Okay, how do you know? Judge Welker to Officer Anderson, how do you know? What have you got? If he's a drug dealer, you must have talked to somebody. Where did they purchase these things? You see, this information was all available. And it, either they lied about it, and it wasn't there, and they put it in the affidavit to make my guy look like a scumbag, or it was there, and they knew that they didn't have any particular information that there were drugs in the house, and they decided they didn't want to talk about it.
Mr. Dunn,
yes, sir.
Let me interrupt for a minute. Was there a transcript of the hearing for the issuance of the search warrant, or is there merely an affidavit?
There's merely an affidavit, Your Honor.
How do you know that Judge Welker didn't ask some questions of the officers before issuing the search warrant?
Because it would have had to have been recorded, and it would have had to have been provided to me.
Why would it have to be reported? I don't understand that.
Because it would have been part of the affidavit in support, so that when the warrant is returned to the clerk, it's returned with the affidavit in support and any depositions that were taken of the officer, along with the return that is what they found in the house. That's required by statute. And it wasn't there, and I checked.
So you're saying, just so I understand,
yes, sir,
that the affidavit process requires the police come in, magistrate is there, Judge, we bring this in, and you're saying that's all recorded, everything that goes on at that point?
No.
I want to.
No, the only thing, what I'm saying, I don't even think that they have to be there. I mean, I think they can drop off the warrant on the judge's desk, and he can review it and sign it. What I'm saying in this case, that if there was a deposition of the officer was physically in front of Judge Welker, and he asked him a question which would supplement the affidavit, the statute requires that be recorded. And in this case, it wasn't, and I know it wasn't, not because I deposed Welker, but because I went and checked in the clerk's office, and I didn't find it there, and I also didn't find it in discovery, and it wasn't disclosed by the state, and it would have had to have been disclosed by the state.
At the time of the motion to suppress hearing, Judge Welker explained on the record, apparently, what he was thinking about.
Correct.
At the time he went ahead and issued the search warrant. Is that not correct? He talked about the fact that he was relying on his experience.
Right. Yes. Yes.
Did you question him at all about that?
Yes, I did. I mean, it's in the record, but we talked for a long time about this. It's a pretty good record. And I reminded him that there was such a thing as a four-corner rule. And I said, I don't think that you can exchange the hat of the magistrate for the coat of the police officer and make these findings. And he said, but it's in my experience. And I said, why didn't you ask the police officer what the experience was? I said, all you had to do is say, Officer Anderson, how many investigations you've been involved in where you've actually executed warrants? And I think he said like 135 or something like that. And I said, all you had to do is say to him, in how many cases did you find drugs? You see, you can get away from this blanket rule that they want you to adopt by just supervising the judges and magistrates and saying, just ask the police officer what his experience is. The thing that you have to remember in this case, there is nothing in the affidavit in support of the warrant to indicate that there were ever any drugs in this house. And the police, I'm sorry, but the police officer didn't proffer that information. Now, if the police officer had said, either orally or in the affidavit, you know, in at least 50% of the cases, or 50 to 80% of the cases, we find that when we have identified a drug dealer, we find drugs, and he put that in there or swore to it in front of the judge, then I think the state would have a stronger case for reversal.
Would it be your position that the magistrate can rely on the experience of the police officer, but he can't rely on his own experience?
Seems to be
what you're saying.
Well, have you ever had that experience of seeing a transcript where you've said something that you wish you hadn't said? that's my plight in this case. But I'm sorry.
In other words, that is what your position is.
Well, my position would be today that it was a much stronger position for the state. I did concede that at the trial court level, and I noticed that the Court of Appeals sort of took me to task for it and say, well, defense counsel might have conceded it, but we're not going to make that type of finding. So I don't know where that...
Well, a concession is a legal concession, not a factual.
Correct.
We don't have to agree with your legal concessions.
I don't...
Counsel, are you finished answering? I don't want to interrupt. Justice Crooks, is he finished answering?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Under 968.12 sub 2, a warrant can be issued on a finding of probable cause only based on a sworn complaint, on an affidavit, or testimony. You've used the phrase four-corner rule. Are you basing that on 968.12?
No, I guess I'm saying that the way I learned the law is... If it's not within the four corners of the affidavit or something that was supplemented legally, then a neutral magistrate is not authorized to go outside of the four corners of the affidavit. And I think that's exactly what happened in this case.
When you say affidavit, you mean affidavit or sworn complaint or testimony?
That's correct, right. And in this case, it was an affidavit. It wasn't a complaint. And that is in the record. I think I might have a minute left. I don't think in this particular case that that you need to reach Leon in the Ward facts. First of all, let me finish by saying I don't think that this is an error correcting a court. I mean, I don't know why you would want to. I think the Court of Appeals applied the correct law here. I think that they distinguished that there was absolutely no information to make the nexus or the link. And what Mr. Kleinmeier and the state of Wisconsin want you to do is do what the legislature ought to do. They want you to create a legal presumption, not unlike the legal presumption that 0.10 is, as a matter of law, under the influence of an intoxicant, or that the Intoxilizer 5000 machine is a workable machine without any kind of scientific testimony needed, and it's rebuttable, and that's what they're asking you to do. I think that this is something that's probably better left to the legislature. With respect to Leon, I think it's clear in this case, let me talk just a little bit about some more facts. We went back and looked at what Officer Anderson had done in the 15 months preceding and a couple months subsequent to his asking for the warranted ward. You know, and what he did is they push computer buttons and they get this wonderful, colorful language that they put in affidavits. And this is going on all over the state of Wisconsin. And then they take these to the judge. And in this particular case, he said, in my experience, drug dealers and people who are involved in drug crimes are likely to have guns and they will use them against police officers. Now, that might be true, but when you come before Judge Welker and you ask for this particular warrant, that in the previous 21 warrants that you have asked for in drug cases, 20 of 21, you have found but one gun, I say that that is misleading. My time is up.
Time of the half hour is yours, sir.
Let me finish that thought, and then I'm going to defer to you. I think that you don't have to reach Leon here, and the reason is because I think objectively the police did not handle this well. I think they were not candid with Judge Welker. They made him scramble. And if you read the transcript, Welker knew he was in trouble when we were talking about this because he said, you know, you may be right here, but, you know, I've been doing this for a long time. I always go outside into my own experience. And maybe he needs to do that because the police in Rock County sit on special operations file. They do not share adequate information with
you. Is this part of the record, the things you're telling us now?
Yes, sir.
What record? The record before Judge Welker?
The record before Judge Welker, the interchange between myself and Judge Welker. And there are 20...
Were you offering proof or were you just arguing?
We had a hearing on this. We had, after conviction, before sentencing, when Richards was decided, I asked for a hearing to determine whether or not there was any reasonableness or good faith in which these officers acted, and I submitted all of these affidavits. They're of record. And what they show is that improper information was given to Judge Welker. He didn't know about it. The police knew about it. I think that raises a Franks issue. So I don't believe that
you can tell you about in other cases improper information was presented to
him. Improper information was presented to Judge Welker when the police officer knowingly said that, you know, in my experience, you're going to find guns with drug dealers, when he knew, in fact, that in the last 20 cases he was involved in, where he personally asked for a no-knock warrant and got it, he knew that he had not found guns. I think that's the kind of information that must be provided to a magistrate. If you don't do it, you're being dishonest. I think Brady is a case that was decided by this Supreme Court, said, look, if there isn't an objective showing of good faith, we don't even have to look at Leon, because I think that they wanted you to look at Leon in that case, too. I would like the rest of the time to be used by Mr. Eisenman. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Eisenberg.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My mission here this morning is to persuade the Court not to adopt a good faith exception to the state exclusionary rule that you adopted 75 years ago in the Hoyer case. And I think to put this in context, you would only reach this issue if you find there was no probable cause, if you reject Mr. Dunn's argument. And just by saying that, you will have changed the law in this state. This Court has never, to my knowledge, admitted evidence where you have found no probable cause for the issuance of the warrant unless it falls under one of the other recognized exceptions. So even at the outset, simply reaching the issue would represent a change of the law in this state. And of course, as I point out in the brief I filed for amici, that this Court, as a matter of state constitutional law, adopted the probable cause requirement long, long before Mapp versus Ohio incorporated the Fourth Amendment into the 14th. You know, as I was preparing for this argument, I reflected upon the fact that 140 years ago, this Court declared the Fugitive Slave Act to be unconstitutional. And when that case got up to the United States Supreme Court, Justice Taney, in a fairly aggressive decision, reversed this Court in Abelman versus Booth. And when the mandate of the Supreme Court got back to this Court refused to enter the mandate. And it still refused to enter the mandate 140 years later, and thereafter the Court again held the Fugitive Slave Act to be unconstitutional. Now, the Court shouldn't have done that. There were lots of problems in Abelman versus Booth. This case presents a similar-looking kind of structure, particularly given the way the state has argued it. That is, the United States Supreme Court, in its wisdom, in Leon, said that there's a good faith exception. Under the Fourth Amendment. That is, that if the police have a good faith belief that they were operating consistently with the Fourth Amendment, it really doesn't matter that they were violating the constitutional rights of the individual whose premises were searched. And the state's entire argument, as I understand it, is you have to follow Leon because the United States Supreme Court decided Leon. And because back in 1923, when you decided Hoyer, you decided to follow the United States Supreme Court decision in Weeks. And the state does not argue, and I gave them an opportunity in the amici brief to say this is a better rule that will protect the citizens of this state to a better extent. They don't argue that. They said back 76 years ago, you followed Weeks. Therefore, in 1999, you should follow Leon. And let me tell you why you should not do that. Hoyer indeed was based on Weeks. In Weeks, the United States Supreme Court said unequivocally that the exclusionary rule was designed to protect the rights of individual citizens who were the subject of search. This court reiterated that holding in Hoyer and repeated that holding in a series of cases, saying, up until at least 1956, that in order for that rule to change, the Constitution had to be amended long before Mapp versus Ohio was decided, long before the notion of selective incorporation of any of the enumerated rights into the 14th Amendment was anywhere on the horizon. This court had established a right of the citizens not to have unconstitutional searches occur. It was never, has never been, a rule of this state's constitution that the exclusionary rule was to deter police misconduct. That is foreign to Article 1, Section 11 of the Wisconsin Constitution.
So it's the positive to protect the citizens, not the police.
For two reasons. Well, for three reasons. One, the court did say it was a restraint on the officers. But that was clearly the third of three reasons. The primary reason, said loudly and clearly in these drug cases of the 1923s and the 1930s, and they were drug cases, different drugs. The drug of choice back then was illegally making alcohol, and that's where Weeks came, and that's where Hoyer and all these other cases. But in those drug cases, the court said the primary right is the individual liberty of the people whose premises are searched. The second problem is that this court, and this court said this very forcefully in the Gladowski case in 1928, this court cannot utilize that evidence. In Calandra, the United States Supreme Court disavowed any part of the exclusionary rule as concern about the courts admitting illegally seized evidence. The court, which I thought before Calandra had viewed as had this court, that one of the reasons we have an exclusionary rule is because the court doesn't want to be the party, doesn't want to have sort of dirty hands dealing with tainted evidence. This court clearly has said that, but the United States Supreme Court sort of dropped that issue. And what happened is, and we can disagree about whether this was a good development on the federal level or a bad development on the federal level, in Calandra, the United States Supreme Court changed the rules under the Fourth Amendment. From Weeks until Calandra, the Fourth Amendment exclusionary rule, without question, was the personal liberty of the person whose premises were seized. After Calandra, in a series of cases that continue to today, and include Leon, the court has viewed the exclusionary rule under the Fourth Amendment as exclusively a way to deter police misconduct. This court has never read the state constitution in that way. It should not. There is no reason to. The burden has to be on the Attorney General to show that a rule which was adopted in 1923 should be changed in 1999. And the only reason they can come up with, in all of the briefs they filed in the three cases you're hearing this morning, is that the United States Supreme Court says so.
Well, with due respect, Mr. Eisenberg, our court has said in numerous cases, since selective incorporation, and I don't know whether it said it before that, but that where the language of the state constitution in the Declaration of Rights is identical or virtually identical or substantially identical with the language of the U.S. Constitution, this court will follow the interpretation of the United States Supreme Court, even if it changes its mind. And after it says that, and said that in a number of cases, and in many search and seizure cases, it always says, what, I shouldn't say always, the court many times says, but the court reserves the right to grant its citizens more rights than the United States Supreme Court grants under its interpretation to all the citizens. So we've always retained that window of opportunity, but I think we'd be hard-pressed to find a case recently where this court has granted more rights than the United States Supreme Court in its interpretation.
Well, with due
in
respect,
search and seizure.
Oh, in search and seizure cases, that's true. Certainly this court has done so as recently as last year in the Hansford case.
That's right. And in First Amendment cases, you'll find that in other areas. But search and seizure, I think you'd be hard-pressed.
Well, except for all of the cases between 1923 and 1968.
A detail.
Well, with due respect, I don't think that's a detail. Because in that era, this court adopted a body of state constitutional law. That was not mandated by the federal constitution. And
Mr. Eichler, let me.
I was being facetious, of course, in saying detail, but that is a body of law in recent years, which you've got to face up to.
It's just, well, may I just say another word to the Chief Justice about that? When you're looking at, in post-MAP cases, when this court has in dicta said things like that, and the Attorney General relies heavily on something Justice Heffernan wrote in dicta, you have to look at the context. And the context there was this court could not change the exclusionary rule at that point, and the court may have said some things believing that it was not going to be in the position that it finds itself in today, which is why I think you have to go back to the era in which this court was relying solely on its own jurisprudence. And I acknowledge there's dicta, but I agree with Chief Justice Hallows. There's good dicta and bad dicta, and the dicta in those cases is not particularly good.
I just want to ask a question about the exclusionary rule, which basically was, judicially created remedy. I'm talking about Leon.
Right.
And when you're talking about creating more rights for the citizens, the public policy would seem to me, and this is a question that if the police haven't acted inappropriately, and yet, in other words, the exclusionary rule wipes out the evidence, but if they haven't acted, what reason for the good faith exception not being affected would prevent this evidence? In other words, the good faith exception from a public policy standpoint would seem to have some merit just based upon the fact that we talk about protection of citizens. In this case, we're talking about the drug situation, and we all understand the policies, both pro and con in that. Just explain to me why the good faith exception would never be appropriate in a case such as this.
Because I have the right to be secure in my house and not have it searched unless there's probable cause for that search.
And Leon said that the exclusionary rule is there for that purpose, that is tainted and never can be used. And what the good faith exception is, that's my understanding.
With due respect, if you adopt the state's position here, you will be allowing a search that was undertaken without probable cause. And yes, these cases come up in the context of people who have bad things in their homes, because innocent people who are subjected to illegal searches usually don't have the wherewithal to bring 1983 cases suing the police for a 10-minute search of their house. But that is the evil that the state exclusionary rule is designed to protect.
Dean Eisenberg, let me ask you a couple of questions, and let's, if we might, focus for a minute on the issues tied to the no-knock entry.
Yes.
In that particular situation, we have police officers obviously relying on decisions of this court from Stevens and Richards. They don't have to announce, we told them, so they don't announce. Why shouldn't the good faith exception, as spelled out in Illinois versus Crowell, apply in that kind of situation? Why should we penalize the police for accepting decisions of this court and relying on them and acting on them?
Okay. Well, I have a level of responses. In Mr. Kleinmeier's argument, he said that counsel for the defendant did not rely on the state rule, and I don't know if that's true or not, and that might change my answer. I'm assuming in what I'm about to say that there was a state constitutional issue asserted. And if that is not true, then the answer may be different. But the notion, Justice Crooks, of penalizing the police is sort of troubling to me. This isn't sort of like a game where the police win and the defendant loses, or vice versa. The issue is still, what does the Constitution allow? And whether that's a no-knock situation or whether it's a search without probable cause, it seems to me that the concept is the same. If it violates the state constitution, then it is an invalid search. Now, if you want to say, and I guess I will put on my criminal defense hat, that we're going to only apply the good faith exception to this narrow band of cases that exist between this court's decision and the U.S. Supreme Court's decision, that is certainly a less troubling result than if you adopt Leon, which applies to without probable cause. But I think from a principal point of view, with due respect, the issue is the same. The search is either good or it's not good, and good faith doesn't really change the constitutional law. We're not assigning fault to police officers. Police officers have a tough job, and it's hard enough for lawyers to figure out what the law is. But I don't think that's the way to look at it. This is the issue of the rights of the individuals. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Eisenberg, Assistant Attorney General Kleinmeier,
in rebuttal. When Mr. Eisenberg was asked why he should not apply the good faith exception, he said he has a right to be secure in his home. Well, as Justice Heffernan pointed out in Conrad, the exclusionary rule protects the innocent only to the extent it can deter the misconduct. That if the police burst into Mr. Eisenberg's home and do a one-hour search and find no evidence, the exclusionary rule doesn't protect him because there's nothing to keep out of evidence. The only way it protects the innocent is by deterring future conduct by the police. I don't know how you deter future conduct of the police when they act in compliance with the search warrant and they act out of in compliance with the decision of this court. So, I mean, the deterrence is tied in with the protection of the individual rights. Those rights are protected only to the extent that the police can be deterred.
That's for the future, but what about this person's rights?
But the point is, well, here, Justice Heffernan also discussed this balancing of costs and the purpose of the rule. So there's the cost of this to the exclusionary rule. You're keeping out legitimate evidence, relevant and reliable evidence. And he said the integrity of the courts is compromised by keeping that out when to the extent that the exclusionary rule's purpose is not being accomplished. Well, when you can't accomplish the rule, the purpose, the deterrence purpose of the rule, which is to hopefully control future conduct, if you're not accomplishing that, then it's not worth the other cost that you're paying. And those are the reasons that, plus the consistency, the court's consistency with other decisions of the U.S. Supreme Court and the Fourth Amendment, and that this balancing of there's no reason to exclude the evidence when you're not accomplishing its purpose of deterring future conduct.
Mr. Kleinbaum, if we should determine that the affidavit here was sufficient to establish probable cause, that the search warrant was okay, do we still have to address the good faith or the causal relationship issues because of the no-knock?
Yes. I think that if you find the search warrant affidavit is valid, you don't have to address the good faith in regard to the search warrant. But there's still the question of what happens to the challenge to the no-knock entry. I mean, there's two different challenges the defendants raised. And I think on that, the first question is when you apply the exclusionary rule. And I think the U.S. Supreme Court has made it very clear it's applied to only evidence that's seized as a result. There has to be at least a but-for connection between the police illegal conduct and the evidence that's seized. Causal relationship. That's the first step. Now, there are times, even when you have that causal relationship, that the evidence is still not suppressed. For example, the attenuation doctrine, because it's far enough removed to get out of the causal chain. But that cause is the first step. And the more recent cases, to say that by the U.S. Supreme Court, is Segura, which the facts may be different, but its underlying principle is you have to have this causal connection. And then in Ramirez, which was a no-knock case, and in the footnote there, footnote 3, the court found there that the no-knock entry was valid. So they didn't have to get to the next question of suppression. The Court of Appeals, on the other hand, in that case, had found it invalid and suppressed the evidence. And the court just said in the footnote, because we find it's valid, we don't have to reach the question of whether there's a sufficient causal connection between the breaking of the window and the discovery of the gun to justify suppression. So I think that's very clear that you look to specific police misconduct. When the police misconduct is simply a failure to announce and they otherwise have a valid search warrant, I don't think there's any causal connection between the failure to announce and the discovery of the evidence. Well, probably not in most cases. I mean, we cite at least one example. The Ramirez case, had the no-knock entry been invalid, I think that would have been a case where it would have been perfectly legitimate to suppress the evidence because the police went there for an arrest warrant for an individual who did not live there. When they broke in, the resident heard someone breaking into his home, grabbed a gun to defend himself. When the police came in, there he was holding the gun. He was charged with a felon in possession of a firearm. Now, that was a case where the only reason he went and grabbed his gun was because someone was breaking into his house. And since the police came with an arrest warrant, it's probable that they would not have found that gun if they just, knocked on the door, came in and asked about the person they were looking for, searched for that person, and that gun had been in a drawer somewhere, they never would have found it. So, I could see that kind of situation being a causal connection.
But that would be a minority.
It might be, but the fact of the matter is you still have to have this causal connection. And as the Supreme Court pointed out in Nixon-Segura, there are the remedies, the civil remedies. Now, defendants always say, well, Matt versus Ohio says you can't rely on the civil remedies. But again, that's assuming you have the causal connection first. Then you apply the exclusion, then you can look at the exclusionary rule. And as far as the concern of the police will now never have to comply with no-knock, we cited City of Canton, Ohio versus Harris, as a 1983 case, and the court there held that even the municipality, if they fail to train their employees, can be held responsible. And Justice O'Connor, in her concurred in part and dissented in part, she pointed out if the municipality is aware of repeated violations by their employees, they could be held responsible.
Our counsel, can these no-knock good faith? It really seems to me it's not a very valid argument, because whether you get a no-knock warrant or not, it's irrelevant, because it's when the police go to the door that they have to decide whether they have the facts to enter without a knock. So Leon applies in a warrant situation, but the warrant as to the no-knock aspect falls as soon as you get to the door.
Well, there's two aspects to that. First of all, let's just address the situation where the police replied on the blanket rule in Stevens and Richards. There, I think, you can certainly apply a good faith, because the court said you don't have to look at the circumstances when you get to the door. If you have a drug dealer, you can make a no-knock entry. So
as to those cases, but they're dead. I'm talking about the future.
Okay, the future. The police have to make the judgment at the door. However, even in Richard versus Wisconsin, the Supreme Court acknowledged that you can get the authorization of the search warrant. Now, if they present facts to the judge, the magistrate who issues the warrant, and the judge thinks that's sufficiently justifying a no-knock and authorizes a no-knock, I think they can rely on that warrant as long as the facts remain the same. If between the time of getting the warrant, and going to the door, something changes that would now wipe away the reasonable suspicion, the police couldn't rely on it. But it seems to me if the facts remain unchanged, the police have already been told by that warrant that their facts have been approved to justify a no-knock warrant. And a judicial magistrate, the judiciary, has approved that. And to that extent, I think they then can rely on that for good faith.
You're going to have a differentiation.
On whether the facts have changed between the warrant and the time they get to the door. If they get to the door and facts have changed, then yes, then they have to make a decision.
Thank you, Mr. Kleinmeier. That ends our hearing on 97-2008-CR, State v. Ward. And we're calling our second case.